Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Treasures from Malta podcast, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection, and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today is elegance personified. Her petit frame belies the incredibly powerful singing voice that has made her a household name. Her musical repertoire is vast, and she is equally comfortable singing Baroque opera as she is with 20th century compositions. She has worked alongside such greats as Placido Domingo and Joseph Calleja, and sung to much acclaim in the US and across the major capitals of Europe. She is consistently lauded in reviews, and while her musical prowess is at its peak, she is also engaged in various projects focusing particularly on musical education, setting up and directing choirs both for professional performances and for community engagement purposes. She sees power in music and song, not just to uplift and delight audiences, but also to heal and enhance the performer's life. Gillian Zambit, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Francesca. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Gillian, was there a point in your childhood when you knew that your voice could be your art and your profession?
Well, I think from the earliest stage that I can remember, I've always loved music. And obviously, when you're young, you don't have a concept of a profession or doing something for a living. But my sister used to play the piano, and I always remember sitting on my mother's lap, watching my sister play the piano and just thinking, I want to do that as well. And that's how it started. And it all, I started playing the piano when I was 5 years old. And as I started growing older and understanding what, you know, music was and possibility of a career, that's all I ever wanted. So it was actually piano that started off my musical life, not singing. And my intention was to study here until I got my diploma. And then I intended to get accepted in an academy in London. I really wanted to go to the Royal College, which is placed exactly in front of the Royal Albert Hall. And my dream was I'd go to the Royal College, I'd graduate, and then I'd cross the road to the Royal Albert Hall, and there I'd make my debut playing Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. That was it in my mind.
Very clear in what you wanted to do.
Very clear. And then, when I was about 12 or 13, my mum was English, and she used to sing in the choir at St. Patrick's, because that's where we used to go on Sundays. And, you know, I'd always go with her, so I used to join in and just sing along with them. And the choir master there, Alfred Camilleri, he said, you know, you've got a very sweet voice, why don't you go for singing lessons? You know, you do piano as well, it would be nice to go to singing as well. And I thought, okay, that would fit in well with my plan, because at the Royal College I knew that you needed a second instrument. So singing would be my second instrument. So that was the plan. And I was 13. I started lessons with Antoinette Bejani at the time. Mm-hmm. And very slowly, even without me realizing, my voice took over from the piano. And It was really, I felt that I could express myself much better. I was much freer to express myself with my voice as opposed to the piano. With the piano, I was always more concerned with the technique side of things. But when I sang, I just felt, you know, obviously working on technique as well, but it was easier, much easier to express. So the instrument switched, basically. So it was always music, but there was just an instrument swap halfway. Well, not even halfway through, which is pretty much quite early on.
What happened after that, after Antoinette Bejani?
So I studied with Antoinette for a number of years, and then I studied with Paul Asher. They were both very supportive, Paul especially. He was, you know, he said, you know, you need to go abroad. You should study abroad. And he helped prepare me for an audition with Carlo Bergonzi in Parma, in Italy. And age 20, I left Malta and I moved to Italy. And we were based just outside Parma in a very small village called Busseto. And Carlo Bergonzi was one of the greats, I mean, all-time greats. Really a living legend meeting him, meeting such a fantastic tenor who was, you know, renowned for his interpretation of Verdi. And he based his academy in Busseto, which was a tiny, tiny village. No distractions, no cinema, no bars, no nothing. It was like a little piazza, a little road, where there was a man who sold cheese and another man who sold ham, and then a coffee shop on the corner where all the old men of the village would meet, and that was it. But he based it there. He was a huge disciplinarian. He was very much of the mind that you are here to study singing, and you're not here to do anything else. You're not here to enjoy yourself. You're not here to go out and party. You're just here to study. And he based himself in Busseto because he, and that was Verdi country, basically. Verdi was born just outside Busseto, lived in Busseto for a long time. So it was an excuse, really, just to keep us away from the bright lights. and then I spent 4 years with him, and it was a wonderful 4 years, not only from a technique point of view, but he really prepared me for life in the real world. He was very, very tough. And I was very grateful when I left him that he was very tough. At the time, I wasn't, because obviously you're young, so you didn't want to have the element of, you know, enjoying yourself as well. But he was so strict. And it really served me well because it made me very tough. He could actually, you know, if he found out that you had gone out one weekend, you know, he would leave us the weekend and come back on Monday morning. We'd sneak out, we'd find someone to take us to the neighboring town just to go for a dance or a drink, you know, something very innocent, very normal. But if he found out, then you were, I mean, not in trouble, but he would humiliate you at your next lesson. Like I said, it really served well because, you know, critics, you know, they can say what they like. You know, you know, when you're prepared from such a young age to face that kind of harshness, you know, then you really, you're set up for this profession because it's very tough. It's a disappointing profession at times. It's got its great highs, but then obviously when it's got its lows, it's really low. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a learning curve. And then after Bergonzi, I moved to Victoria de Los Angeles, mm-hmm. who was again another legend of her time. And, with her, I worked more on song rather than opera.
Mm-hmm.
And, she really opened my mind, and she made me realize that even that was where my musical, tastes lie, really. I love opera. Of course, I do opera. I sing opera, you know, but it's not what I love to do. I love chamber music. I love song recital. And she really brought that out in me, and she was a wonderful teacher. So, and then after I, stopped having lessons with her, and then kind of you start your career and you have to.
During these years when you were training, you were sort of cut off in a way, as you explain, although you were subject to all this discipline and you were prepared extensively. Were you also performing limitedly, perhaps, as a student?
Very limitedly, because there were different times, and even locally, like when I'd come back to Malta, there were very limited things happening in those days. I mean, when I was starting off, you know, 15, 16, you were lucky if you sang once a year. I mean, it was like very few things. We forget, and this generation as well has no idea of what it was like in those days, in the 90s, you know, 2000s, early 2000s. There was nothing happening, very little. There was maybe an MCI concert, which was organized once a month, the few odd little concerts here and there, but there was nothing of the scale that we have today. So we didn't get a lot of performing practice. And even studying abroad in Italy, it was very difficult because if there was an opportunity, then 9 times out of 10, it went to an Italian because the Italians are very good like that because they look after their own first. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, they give the opportunity to the local talent rather than the foreign who might be studying there. So no, in that period, I wouldn't say I had a lot of performing experience.
At what stage did you feel that you had arrived? I mean, was there a particular performance where you thought, I've made it, you know, I'm finally a fully fledged performer, I've arrived?
I can't say that I ever thought that I've made it. There have been performances where I've really felt satisfied, either because I would have sung something that would have been, you know, a dream to have sung for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And that performance would have gone as you wished that that performance would, mm-hmm. you know, turn out, because it's something, a piece of music that means so much to you.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's evolving, constantly evolving. And because as well, the voice, everybody's voice constantly evolves and matures. The things, I couldn't sing certain things when I was 18 that I can sing now. Mm-hmm. And then in 10 years' time, I may be able to sing different rep again, because your voice is constantly changing and maturing and darkening. And so it's a constant evolvement. That's why I can't ever say I've made it, because it's just constantly mm-hmm. changing and progressing, I think.
Gillian, what do you mean by your voice darkening?
When I was younger, I was a light coloratura soprano. As you get older, the voice, even without any form of training, just changes.
Mm-hmm.
It does become, I call it vocal middle age spread. the color does change. Mm-hmm. So people who, again, who might not have heard me for a long time, today will say, oh, wow, your voice is different. It's much darker. It's richer. It just does change. It's nature. And then, of course, when you train your voice and you have a set technique, and then you can adapt the way you sing to the voice that you have at that time. In fact, recently I recorded for Gauletana in Gozo, are doing some online operatic scenes. We did them first during COVID last year, and yes, this year they're doing them again. And I sang the aria from Pagliacci, which 10 years ago you told me I'd sing Pagliacci, I would be like, no. Forget it, because I didn't have the weight of sound to be able to sing that piece, also with the weight of the orchestra. You know, these are all things you have to think about. But I can sing it now, so it's nice that mm-hmm. There's always something new to learn. So
absolutely, it's exciting in that sense. And do you feel that your style is evolving as well? Can you speak about a style?
Yes, I mean, I think my style has always been more about the music and the text as opposed to showing off of my voice.
Mm-hmm.
So this was something as well that I really learned from Victoria de Los Angeles, because she was wonderful in that respect. The text was not more important than the music, but they went hand in hand, and especially mm-hmm. with the kind of pieces that I like to sing, the song recitals, Schubert, Schumann, Strauss, the text is fantastic poems written by poets of the day. So you don't only have a beautiful piece of music, but you've got a beautiful poem to pay respect to as well.
Mm-hmm.
And these pieces were written so well that the poetry and the music just combine so mm-hmm. beautifully. It's you can't say the music is more important than the text or vice versa, mm-hmm. because they are a duo. So I've always really felt it's super important to really understand the language and the lyrics that you're singing. And it's not just having a general idea, okay, this phrase means I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Basic, this phrase is talking about different colors and different shades and different, and how can you express that, and how can you give the right color to your voice if you don't know what every single word means? So that is maybe what my style is about.
In fact, your repertoire is really vast. It takes you from the Baroque to the 20th century, so that cuts across many centuries. Is it necessary for you to understand the age that the music and lyrics were created in? And by that, I mean kind of the context. And in a way, you've touched upon the emotional aspect of the context, and you want to understand deeper, and you want to understand if it's poetry, you have to understand where it's coming from. And if so, what sort of research do you do in preparation for a role that sort of is set in a particular century and with a particular style?
I would say it's hugely important, and it's you have to know what was happening in that period and why that composer was influenced to mm-hmm. write in that way, and by whom he was influenced, might have been musicians of the day, it might have been the poets of the day, the artists of the day.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening in the world at that time? Was there a war in that area? What was there? It's all comes together. There is a reason why Shostakovich's symphonies sound as they do, because it reflects what was he went through in his life. And why does Debussy sound the way he does? Because he was part of the Impressionist circle with the painters and the poets of that period. So that is why that style and the way you sing has to reflect the style of the period. That's why it's so important that, you know, it's something that I really stress to young singers coming up. It's not only about your voice. Your voice is the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you have to have a good voice to be able to sing, but that is just where you set off from.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a musical understanding, a strong musical understanding, and if you don't have an understanding about the circumstances in which the pieces that you were singing were composed in, then yes, you can sing, but you're going to give a very superficial interpretation and a very superficial performance of the music that you're meant to be trying to not only pay respect to, but give your audience that emotion. So if you don't understand it, then there's no way you're going to expect your audience to understand it.
Absolutely. Music to my ears, excuse the pun, but as historians in any discipline, really, it's always so important to look at the context, because it gives you such a greater understanding of how a piece of art was created, be it music, be it the visual arts. So it's wonderful to hear that even from your end of things, you're looking at even perhaps the visual arts, the political situation at the time, the economic situation, what health scares were on at the time. I mean, we've seen in our day how health scares can really impact our life, and we'll talk about it later. Do you actually look at the visual arts? Is there any crossover for you?
Yes, I'll come back to Victoria de Los Angeles, because she was such a wonderful person. I think it was my second lesson with her, and I was kind of still on my really best behavior, you know, just starting off with somebody, especially someone so great. I just wanted to make such a good impression with her. And I think it was the second lesson, we were working on a Schubert song, and she stopped me and she said, "Do you go to art galleries?" And like in that moment, I was like, what's the right answer? I do go, but is she going to say, and I had just come out of lessons with Bergonzi, who for Bergonzi, it was just singing and nothing else. So I was thinking, okay, is she going to, if I say yes, is she going to say, well, you should be focusing just on your singing because you're not good enough? And always that moment, I just said, let me be honest. And I said, yes, I do go to art galleries, you know, when I have the time. She said, well, the next time you go, she said, just go and find, Monet or Manet, she said, and just go and stand in front of the painting. She said, and go as close as possible. And she said, and have a look, just at a leaf. She said, and have a look and see how many different shades of green went into that one leaf. Go and have a look at the pond and see how many shades of blue went in to create that pond. She said, and then take a step back and look at the bigger picture. She said, so with your voice, she said, every note you sing has to have a different shade. Then all those different shades put together create the emotion and the feeling and the color that you're portraying to your audience. And that just stuck with me forever.
Fantastic. A few minutes into this recording, you already were mentioning things like color and the darkening of the voice. You mentioned paintings, you mentioned artists. So already it's very clear to me that somehow you're visualizing your music as well. Conversely, I've come to music in a way through painting. I'm a visual person myself, so I go to museums. They are my bread and butter, practically. That's my research. And recently I've started to listen to music rather than read captions at museums. I listen to the music of the time. I just stream it as I'm walking along the halls of a museum. And it's changed the way I look at paintings. So, you know, the crossover is so enriching. But looking at a different art, looking at sort of a performing art, I just wanted to ask you as well, that critics have not only lauded your voice and your versatility, but they've also mentioned things like your diction, memory, and your acting skills. For example, I'll quote Albert Storace in the Times of Malta. He says this about you. He says, she's amazingly versatile, technically and musically up to scratch, and is mnemonically impressive, with a wide exploitation of vocal range. And then, Cecilia Schwerek in the Sunday Times of Malta. Her coloratura is crystal clear and is matched by perfect diction in whatever language she may be singing in. Now, is acting part of your training?
It is. It is. And it's a very important part because, again, gone are the days when you can just stand on stage and deliver an aria, just standing face onto the audience and just, you know, expect it to work. Today, the audience expects to go to an opera and have it be believable. And opera is that. Mm-hmm. Opera is such a multi, you know, it's not just about the music, it's a visual, it's the stage, it's the setting, it's the lighting. It's got so much, you know, it's a
total work of art.
Total work of art, exactly. And today you do have to be believable as an actress. If you're singing Traviata, people want to believe that you're dying of consumption. You know, if it has to be believable. And I think it really is a good thing because it's helping, especially the younger. I think there's more of an element of acting in the younger generation of singers coming up because mm-hmm. in colleges and academies today, it's a huge part of their training. In my day, I did have some acting lessons, but they weren't as important in those days as they should have been. Mm-hmm. I've been very fortunate when I've been in operas to work with very good directors who have, you know, really helped you bring out the skills that you have. And again, if you are fully immersed into your character and you are looking at it from the point of view of the character and the text, then the acting kind of comes not on its own, but it's if you're just looking at it right, okay, now I just need to cross the stage and here I have to do something with my arms because it's uncomfortable and this, you know, it just obviously doesn't work. But that mm-hmm. means that you're not immersed in the character, because if you are thinking about the character and what she is really feeling at that point, then it comes naturally. It's like mm-hmm. we are naturally, and that's what I feel it should be. It should look natural mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you are feeling it to such an extent that you would naturally make a gesture or move in a certain mm-hmm. way because it's part and parcel of what you are expressing.
Is there a voice from the present or even the past that has been a great inspiration to you?
Absolutely, Maria Callas. And because, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but it really is, because she was such a singing actress. She mm-hmm. was the first in her time. I mean, and we're talking about here 50s, 60s, which it wasn't the case. Again, I mean, you would generally find singers quite wooden at the time, you know, it wasn't mm-hmm. really the thing to do, but because she was so dedicated to making sure that every phrase, every word had meaning and had life, you listen to her recordings and it's just, she sings from deep, somewhere so deep mm-hmm. inside, and she just brings out the colors and the emotions. And there's a recording of her singing, I think in the 1960s in Covent Garden. And she was doing Tosca with Tito Gobbi as Scarpia, again, another fantastic acting singer. And they were directed by Zeffirelli. And Zeffirelli wasn't in retirement, but she had kind of taken a little step back. This was the time she was with Anasis, so sort of career had taken a little bit of a back step. And he kind of persuaded her to come to Covent Garden and sing this Tosca. And if you look it up on YouTube, just type in Tosca, Act 2, Maria Callas, Covent Garden. She sings Visi d'Arte. And mm-hmm. I swear, I've sung, I've heard it so many times. Every time I just sit there and I cry. It's just like... But she sings it because you can see she's this woman at that time of her life as well. And she's saying, I gave everything for art, yet you do this to me. And it's obvious she's singing about her own life story, mm-hmm. but because mm-hmm. it's so real to her, then it's so real to you.
Utterly convincing. Wonderful. Let's take a break now and let's listen to you.
Sure. This is, I think, one of my favorite songs. It's by a composer called Paolo Tosti. And Tosti wrote so many beautiful songs. And this is my absolute favorite, called L'Ideale. And this is myself and Lucia Micalle from piano. And we recorded the CD of Tosti songs quite a few years ago now. And I've always thought Tosti was not admired as much as he should be, but I think he's, you know, he wrote such little jewels of perfect songs, and Ideale is one of them.
This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, soprano Gillian Zamit.
And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Now, Gillian, which is your favourite opera? And I mean, even just to enjoy it, as an audience member? And secondly, which is your favourite role to perform in an opera?
Favourite opera to watch? Probably Rigoletto. I always love that. I mean, it's one of those operas from beginning to end. There's just no moment where you say this music isn't beautiful, the storyline obviously is very dramatic, but it's a fantastic opera. So I'd probably Rigoletto to watch. And my favourite role? Maybe more than a role, simply because I do love song more than I love opera, would be The Four Last Songs by Richard Strauss. They are a fantastic group of songs. It's a song cycle written in 1940s, 1948, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a piece I've had the good fortune to be able to perform. And it is just such a wonderful piece of music. It's my, you know, if I could only ever sing another piece ever again, it would be that one.
Are they particularly challenging from the point of view of a recital singer?
Yes, they are very technically demanding. Strauss wrote very high tessitura, so he wrote for very high voice. These are particularly high, and they're also... phrases are extremely long, so there's a lot of breath control required. And also the orchestra is of quite a substantial size. So, you know, you have that weight of sound as well to deal with. So it's not only the agility, height of piece, but also it needs quite a broad sound. So there's a lot of technical demand there. And then especially emotionally, they are four songs that they deal with death. The first one is called Spring. Doesn't actually deal with death, but that is the introduction to the next piece, which is called September. And it's then it moves. It's a slow progression. The last piece is called At Sunset. And it's such a beautiful, and it's not morbid in any way. It's just a very calm acceptance of that which is going to come to everybody. Mm-hmm. And Strauss wrote it at the end of his life. And it was obviously he felt that, you know, he had done everything and he was content with what he had done and total acceptance of what the next step was. And there's such beautiful pieces, really.
We've spoken a lot about emotion. Let's talk about excitement now. I mean, the excitement of performing. Which bit do you find most exciting? The moment before the curtains open, the applause at the end when you know you've done well, or even the most challenging passages that you know you've managed to ace?
It's probably a combination of all those things. If it's an opera or something that you're performing with orchestra, I love the moments before you go on stage when the orchestra is warming up. So the one instrument will give that one note and then all the instruments come in and it's organized chaos because everyone's doing their own thing, their own warm up. But it's such a fantastic sound. I love that sound, even when I'm in the audience watching a concert. I just love that moment.
Same here.
The bit before is always the worst. Once you're on stage, then obviously your nerves, you know, once you step on stage and you're fine, it's the build up to that. In fact, I often wish when I wake up in the morning, oh, I just wish I could go and do it now rather than have to wait the whole day and, you know, your nerves build up.
So you still get nervous, Gillian? You still get nervous before performance?
Yes, I'm definitely. And again, I think there are good days and days where you walk out and go out on stage and you know maybe you're not feeling 100%, but you still have to go out on stage and do it. So, again, the nerves and the anticipation is always different, because if you're feeling good and you know you're super prepared and everything, then it's nerves, but it's an excitement as well, wanting to go out there and share what you've prepared. So in that case, you know, you walk on stage and then you're really in control of what you're doing and everything's working. So you start enjoying the performance and then you can, you know, feel the audience on your side. So yes, then obviously if you have to do the same thing and you're not feeling 100%, then it's always harder. There's, you know, you have to pace yourself and the whole evening will just be a little bit more tense for you because, you know, either you've been sick or, you know, you're feeling a little hoarse or whatever, you know, and you can't show the audience. The audience isn't there to feel sorry for you. The audience is still there to enjoy themselves and expect something. So, you know, there are different levels of excitement.
But let's talk about your voice as an instrument. How do you protect your voice? Because it is the one instrument that cannot be replaced. I mean, if something goes wrong with another instrument, presumably you can replace at last moment, but in your case, there's just nothing you can do about it. So how do you go about protecting it? Do you limit the hours of practice? Do you prepare before and ensure that you don't use it for a few hours before? What is the sort of regime?
The regime, I think, more than, I mean, practice, of course, you have to, every voice is different, we're all different. Like, I'm very fortunate, I can pretty much go out and sing without having to warm up my voice too much. There are other voices that need a lot of warm up before they go out on stage. But practice, again, you have to be careful that you do enough, but not too much to tire yourself out, especially obviously leading up to a performance. But I think more than that, it's looking after, making sure that you're always singing the repertoire that suits you. And that is something that is very hard to for younger singers to understand as well. So that is a very big part of training, to understand that, yes, you might love to sing Traviata, but not yet. You sing Traviata in 10 years' time. If you try to sing Traviata before then, you're going to damage your voice. You know, and then what? In 10 years' time, you won't have anything left. And it's very hard, especially today, because you find agents and managers who don't always necessarily have your best interest. They might, you know, have a house calling them and say, well, I need a tenor for this, send someone. And they send the tenor that's available, notwithstanding the fact that it might not be the right time. And that's something I would remember. Paul Asher was very, you know, fantastic with this. He's insistent on sing what you know is right. And your voice will tell you. If you sing something and you know you're struggling, don't try to insist on it. It's obviously there are things that need work. So doesn't mean that you first think something and straight away it fits, but you know that with a bit of work, you'll manage it. There are those pieces you know that just don't fit your voice. So don't try them. Later, and like I said, the voice changes. So later on, you will do things that you couldn't do before. And there's plenty of time. We're lucky that our career can last a long time if you look after the voice. You know, I mean, there are singers singing in their 70s. Because they looked after their voice. Bergonzi was one of them. He was, when I trained with him, he was already in his late 70s. And I remember one day he was so excited. He said, oh, I can't I have to go fly to New York tomorrow. And we were like, oh my God, why? And he said, because there's this big gala at the Met, and Pavarotti's sick. And they've called me instead. And Pavarotti was like 20 years younger than him. And we were all like, oh, okay. Like, you know, you're like 78. And he went, and the newspapers the next day were just like, Gonzi shows them how to do it. And he came back and he was so, you can imagine.
Incredible.
His voice, his technique was secure, and he always sang what suited. Mm-hmm. And so this is such an important thing for young singers to, you know, understand and keep in the back of their mind. There's plenty of time to do the big things.
Mm-hmm.
We'd all love to sing. You have to accept sometimes there are things that you just will never be able to sing, and that's fine. You know, yeah. So that's a big important part of looking after the voice. Also, being careful what you eat, what you drink, alcohol. So if you know you've got a performance coming up, you know, you can't go out and have a few drinks and, you know, certain foods. Everybody's different as well, what foods react to your body and what your body doesn't, you know, tolerate.
Have you had to cancel performances on occasion? I mean, when your voice, when there was something wrong with your voice at the last minute, perhaps flu or something like that. And have you had to stand in for others cancelling?
Yes, I've had to stand in. So, you know, same thing. Someone might be sick and can't perform that night. I think I've only cancelled twice, maybe, or three times. Mm-hmm. And again, it would just literally be once I had chicken pox, so absolutely.
Yeah. That's a complete no-no. We don't want you on stage.
You know, if you're very hoarse, I mean, there's nothing that you can do. Sometimes if you have a cold, you do have to go on stage, just the cold, and you can sing to a certain extent. You just, you know, have to be careful and mark it down as not being a great night for you.
yeah. But let's speak about that horrible 2 years we've just been through. How did you weather the COVID storm? I mean, apart from obviously everything got cancelled for you, all your concerts, I would imagine that you were particularly concerned about how something which is really a highly contagious respiratory disease could affect your voice. I mean, we just didn't know what the long-term effects of COVID were going to be.
That's it. And I am as well. I'm asthmatic. I have been since I was 5 years old. And I did catch COVID. Actually, I caught it this year in June. It didn't affect my voice as such. It did affect my breathing for quite a while. So COVID was very difficult for performers everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, just the cancellation of performances. And I feel, I mean, I don't know if it's my impression only, but it really did feel like we weren't an important part of life for other people. Because it was such an easy thing for people not to go to. I don't know how to describe it.
It was dispensable. On the other hand, especially in the first stages of COVID, when we were so scared of it, and obviously the vaccine wasn't out yet and all that, we turned increasingly to entertainers, to people, to performers. We were looking at music. People were performing out on their balconies. So the value of the arts came to the fore, but particularly the performing arts, don't you think?
I do think to a certain extent, yes, I did, like everybody else, other performers did lots of things online and posted things for people to see. It was a way for you as well as a performer to actually just be at home doing something. And again, sharing it with people that you knew did like, you know, the arts. However, it was then something that I had a discussion with a lot of my friends and peers, not just in Malta, but in the UK and everywhere else, that was all done for free, which was great and absolutely as it should have been at that time. But when we then moved into the second year and there was, you know, sort of talk and some people actually did some performances online and asked for payment because it is, at the end of the day, our profession, like everybody else's. Then you start seeing less interest in people wanting to actually pay to see things online. And, you know, there was a lot of talk as well at the time, you know, well, why don't you, maybe it's time that you go and get a proper job.
Oh,
you know.
Dreadful. What lack of understanding of the arts.
Yes.
But I wanted to move on to something else. Jillian, you've recorded a number of CDs. Tell me about how significant this can be in a performer's career.
I think recording is important. I look at recording, the things I've recorded and the things that I'm hoping to record in the future are pieces, are works that I really love. So it's not a question of recording a CD just to have recorded a CD. It's really for posterity, for myself, to have worked on these pieces and to just leave these pieces there, you know, for the audience to have a greater awareness of these beautiful pieces. And again, I tend to record things that maybe haven't been recorded that often because, you know, again, I don't see the need for me to record things that have been recorded 100 times. I would rather focus on maybe niche composers, again, like the Tosti CD. It's not a huge following, but they are so beautiful and so deserving of an audience that it's kind of more of a labor of love for me, a recording of a CD rather than anything else.
And that was signed up by UK record label Claudio Records.
That's right.
Jillian, let's listen to you in another piece of music. Can you tell me about it?
So this is a piece that I recorded under the auspices of the MPO with Britt Arend, who's the MPO principal harpist, and Frank Camilleri, who plays the cello section of the MPO. And it's a CD we recorded a couple of years ago called Cantilena. And it's a selection of, I think, our favourite songs. We just sat down and we just brainstormed and we all came up with our favourite pieces. And one of them was this, which is called the Baquianas Brasileiras No. 5 by Villa-Lobos.
Talking about more niche projects, you're involved in the Monteverdi project and you've got a very essential role in it. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. So the Monteverdi project was started 5 years ago. It was the idea of Kenneth Samitabona. And it is it's a consort of singers who we brought together because there was such a lack of singers locally who knew how to or specialize in Baroque singing, which is a very specialist kind of style. And I had done a lot of Baroque music. I do a lot of Baroque music. I always have from the age of 13. I first started singing many years ago at that age. I think 15 was the first concert I gave with Maestro Joe Vellangoso and Maria Frendo. And Joe was the first person to really bring music out of the archives in Imdina and bring it back to life. So this music and focusing mostly on Maltese Baroque composers. So I've been singing Baroque music basically since the beginning of my career. And whenever we needed other singers, we'd always have to kind of import them, right? Get Italian singers or English singers. And we came up with this idea of forming a consort made up of local singers and foreign singers who live in Malta. And Kenneth engaged the services of Marco Mencoboni, who is a world specialist on Monteverdi and the composers of that period. He's a harpsichord player. And he comes to Malta basically once a month and gives 3 days of masterclasses in style of the period, and talking to the singers about the style and how to use their voices in that style. And I, in between, prepare them for his visits. And I prepare them for concerts and going through repertoire, and I have sessions with them as well, talking about style, etc. So this is what the Monteverdi project is. And it's really It's really come on in leaps and bounds. We now have around 22 singers. Mm-hmm. And last year, we actually managed to produce Dido and Aeneas, and all the mm-hmm. singers were from the consort. So we didn't have to bring any outside singers mm-hmm. in. And it's really going from strength to strength. Part of the project as well, part of the work that I do with Marco, is going into the archives at MDNA mm-hmm. and again, transcribing and finding music that's never been performed before. And we've done quite a few modern day first performances, which is really nice.
And now this is interesting. So although it's named after Claudio Monteverdi, who was an Italian composer of the 16th, bridging into the 17th century, it's not just Monteverdi's music that you're playing. You're researching music, discovering music in the cathedral archives. Now, you're actually adapting the music as well. Once you discover it, you have to adapt it for the performers. Do you have a hand in doing that?
No, Marco will find the scores, and he's found scores as well, not just in the Indian archives, in archives around the world, particularly of Girolamo Arbos. In fact, we have a concurrent project called the Arbos Project, mm-hmm. Which is discovering music by Girolamo Arbos. And again, we've recorded a CD in Italy last year, which will be out soon. And again, it's amazing. You find this fantastic music that hasn't been performed since those times. And you're the first person to, bring this music back to life. So it is
how
really
exciting.
Nice.
But Gillian, talking about training other singers and everything, you've really been deeply involved in musical education. In fact, you've trained children's choirs as well as adult choirs, both on a community level, but also for operatic productions. Now, I was particularly struck by your involvement with the Teatro Salesian's adult community choir. And this was set up in the middle of COVID chaos in spring 2021. Now, I read an interview with you, and you said specifically about its role, it is aimed at the community rather than looking to be an amateur or professional choir. It is there primarily to offer members of the community an opportunity to make music, but also to socialize. You also talk about the beneficial effects of singing, especially for older people. And you say this, you say music brings people together, and singing in particular helps unlock emotions and can help reduce stress levels. Singing can also improve mental alertness, concentration, and also memory in older adults. Now, Gillian, tell me more about the power of singing.
Singing is, it's a release as well of emotion. And I think it's all instruments, of course, are important and, have their own special traits. But I think the voice, just because it's you, it is you mm-hmm. are your instrument. It is your body. It is you making that sound. I think it's just a very special way of expressing. And the Salesians choir, which you mentioned, it really was a fantastic idea by the Salesians, by Rosetta de Battista, who runs the Teatro Salesiani. And she approached me and she said, what do you think of this idea? And I said, it sounds great. It's something I've always wanted to do because I've always been working with professionals or, young singers who want to be professional. And I had always wanted to do something for a group of people who might never have had the opportunity to do that before. And in fact, during the audition process, which is a very relaxed, I call it audition process, but it's just a fair thing to meet, everybody. Almost everybody said to me, I'm really shy to sing in front of you. I've never been in front of anyone before. And when I was younger, my eldest member is 82. And she was like, when I was younger, it was really frowned upon that you just didn't do this kind of thing. So everybody came into this with with trepidation as well, because they didn't know mm-hmm. what to expect. And like you said, it was during COVID, so sometimes you could meet, sometimes you couldn't. And when we met, it gave me, as the professional, and obviously I do this as a job and it's my daily job, you forget sometimes kind of maybe why you do it, or the excitement, just purely making music for the sake of making music. And this is really what this group gave me, because they would leave the sessions with such a buzz, and I'd go home and I'd be really buzzing. And it was during COVID, so I had no other work. I mean, but it was really, you know, the excitement and the real passion that they had for what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And it was really teaching them everything from scratch, because, like I said, they had no previous experience in being on stage or being in a group or doing certain singing techniques, you know. And when we managed to give a concert at the end, and honestly, the members of the audience, which were all their friends, so we did it at the church, the ballet, and the church was packed with friends and family, and they were just beaming all the way through the concert. And we went off stage, and we did came back on, and we did our encore, and then we went off, and that was it. And you know, it was really great. I'll, you know, see you next year. And they were like, we want to go out and do another one. And I was like, no, but the audience is leaving. Like, it's the concert's over. We want to go back. And they went out again and sang another piece just for the joy of singing. Really.
Oh, lovely. Wonderful. Really. So there are really beneficial effects. I mean, this is not why we do our art, but it's so wonderful that, sort of as an aside, it is so uplifting. And really, the arts are incredibly uplifting in everyone's life. They are for everyone. And this is something that we really need to keep repeating, but it's not just for a select audience. Gillian, in 2020, the St. John's Co-Cathedral Foundation set up a children's choir to be trained by you. Can you tell me how that's going?
That's going really well. We have our first, I would say, really major concert and major collaboration coming up in December. On the 20th of December, we'll have our Christmas concert with the MPO and the MYO, conducted by Philip Walsh. And as you said, this, again, started during COVID. Not the best time to start a children's choir, for any choir of that sort. I started off with 20 children and auditioned them all. And the aim of this choir is to, it's not only to, you know, teach children repertoire, but I also give them a more holistic musical outlook. So we give them theory sessions, do sight reading, talk about the music and the style of that period, so they know, start understanding. And the aim of this is to really create a children's choir. It's first of all to represent St. John's Co-Cathedral Foundation, both locally and abroad. So my idea is in a few years' time to start taking them abroad to festivals and competitions and really creating, you know, a professional children's choir.
Yeah. Can you spot the stars of tomorrow amongst the children you're training?
You can see those who will have the voice and the musicality and the ability to try and train to become, you know. But again, it's so difficult to say who the star of tomorrow is, because as I said before, there's just so much that goes into it apart from music. It's the dedication, it's the discipline, it is the striving every day to make yourself better than you were yesterday. What opportunities am I, what, you know, there's just so much to it, and being prepared for disappointment.
Also, years back in 2009, the BOV Joseph Kalea Choir was set up. And on several occasions, you have coached this choir, which has grown and grown over the years. And as far as I can understand, it's grown to count over 200 children participants. How on earth do you manage to control, to listen to it, to them individually, and then to coordinate them and to create harmony between them? I mean, how do you tackle a massive task like this while protecting your own voice, ultimately, because you need to take care of yourself as well?
Yes, it's the Zuccalea BOV Choir is quite a special thing. We only meet in summer leading up to Joseph's summer concert. So that's the only time it comes together. And yes, it is a big undertaking. But again, I like working with children very much. I mean, I find them sometimes much easier to work with than adults because they are so quick and very responsive. And you know, if you treat them in a mature way, they respond to you and they want to do what you're asking them to do. Not because you're making them, but because they feel that you are trusting them. And the Joseph Pelliot concert obviously is a huge event. They have, you know, really big important singers coming over. It's Bocelli's come, and this year we had Domingo, and, you know, so it's a responsibility for them to be singing on this concert, and it's something that, you know, you have to make them understand. Yes, we've had 250 kids. We've also had 500 kids one year, which was absolutely crazy. Because that
500! Oh my goodness me.
That came about because that year the Pope was visiting and the courier had called us because they knew we had a big children's choir. And they said, we'd like to fill St. George's Piazza with children singing for the Pope.
Let's knock the Pope's socks off.
Exactly. So yeah, we said, well, we have 250. And they said, no, that's not enough. We need to double it. So I thought that this doubling was just for the Pope's visit. And after it went really well. So I would basically do from 6 to 7, I would see 250 children. And from 7 to 8, I'd see the other 250. And then it went so well that the organizers just said, oh, let's keep it for the summer concert. And I madly said, okay, yes. But that was a one-off. We've gone back to 250 now, which seems like a piece of cake after.
But Gillian, what about you? What does the future hold for you? Do you have any exciting projects in the pipeline?
Yes, I've got a few. I'm looking at recording another CD, and there's a CD of music which is again very special to me. And it was meant to happen pre-COVID. Obviously, then things got put on hold. So I'm looking now to starting off the process again next year. Festivals coming up. Singing in an early music festival in Naples in the new year. So yes, working with the kids again, working musical education. And that's for me, I mean, again, performing is a big part of what I do, but I also believe in trying to leave the situation better than how you found it. So mm-hmm. I really, really believe in musical education and working with younger singers and working to make the environment that they work in better. So I think it's important that you are a performer, but it's important then that you pass on what you've learned to the next generation, and that's how it keeps evolving and getting better, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, that's really commendable. So Gillian, a last question and I'll let you go. Can somebody who's completely tone deaf learn to sing? I mean, at least to the extent that she can participate in a choir without destroying its sound completely. And I'm asking for a friend here.
Well, it depends how you can train the voice. You can train your ear, and first you need to take some sessions on maybe some musical training so you can test your ear and start training your ear to respond to certain sounds. I have had in choirs before singers who are maybe not as pitch perfect as other singers, and you can train the voice to join an ensemble and, you know, create a sound that even if is not as good as the others, it can be molded. So, yes.
Positive, a very positive answer. I'll be sure to tell my friend. She's actually probably listening in as we speak.
Very good. Tell her to join the Salesians Choir.
Gillian, thank you so much for sharing your life with us.
Thank you, Francesca. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website. That's www.patrimonio.org.